From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, claims of a second case of the US spying on its so-called German ally threatens to further injure the relationship between Washington and Berlin.
We're getting a lot of calls in the media and from German politicians to reevaluate the relationship with the United States, at least in terms of how much trust the Germans do place in America as a partner.
Also today, the teenage twin sisters who have fled the UK to join the fight in Syria. And we hear from Brazil after goal-happy Germany dismantle the host nation and secure their place in the World Cup final.
I'm almost speechless. You know, I've never seen Germany ruling a game like that.
One down, two down, they were like, okay, Brazil's going to come back, Brazil's going to come back. Then every time Germany touches, they score. Couldn't believe it.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Israel has launched its largest offensive in Gaza for nearly 2 years, killing more than 30 Palestinians in multiple airstrikes. The Israeli Defense Forces say 160 bombings were carried out in total over the past 24 hours. Daniel Taub, Israel's ambassador to Britain, is defending the military assault, calling it a necessary response to Hamas rocket attacks on Israel.
There have been longer-range rockets supplied by Iran that have reached the north of Israel, which means that 3.5 million Israelis have to lead their lives within reach of bomb shelters.
But Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat says he believes there are more Israeli attacks to come.
The Israeli government is fully responsible for this deterioration, and I'm afraid that we haven't seen the worst yet.
Relations between the US and Germany are facing further strain after German authorities searched the home and office of another suspected spy accused of passing confidential information on to the US. From FSN's Berlin Bureau, Ira Spitzer reports.
The new case comes just days after the German public was outraged by the arrest of a first man who may have been selling secrets to the US. The latest case involves an employee of the German Defense Ministry. Some German media outlets are reporting that he is a Bundeswehr soldier who was spying for Washington. American Ambassador John Emerson was at the German Foreign Ministry again, but offered no statement about the latest developments. Ira Spitzer, Berlin.
A new report based on documents leaked by fugitive whistleblower Edward Snowden show the U.S. government spied on Muslim American politicians, civil rights activists, academics and lawyers. From FSN's Washington Bureau, Alice Alstein has the details.
The NSA only has the legal authority to spy on foreigners they believe to be outside the United States and who have connections to terrorism, unless they get a warrant from a federal court. But leaked documents name at least 5 Muslim American leaders, including professors and political candidates, whose emails were monitored for years, though they have never been charged with a crime. Now, civil rights groups are calling on Congress to investigate these claims and pass reforms to the government's surveillance powers. Alice Olstein, Washington.
Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff says the country must not allow itself to be broken by its humiliating 7-1 defeat at the hands of Germany in the World Cup. With presidential elections due in Brazil in October, she urged her countrymen to get up, shake off the dust, and come out on top. Political analysts are debating whether the country's failure to advance to the World Cup final will have any lasting political impact. Many Brazil fans are still licking their wounds.
I'm almost speechless. You know, I've never seen Germany ruling a game like that.
One down, two down, they were like, okay, Brazil's going to come back, Brazil's going to come back. Then every time Germany touches, they score. Couldn't believe it.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Ray Nagin, the former mayor of New Orleans, who became internationally known when Hurricane Katrina slammed into the city, has been sentenced to 10 years in jail after being convicted of corruption. He was facing 20 charges relating to kickbacks he received from contractors looking for city work. He denied all the charges, and prosecutors had been seeking an even longer jail term. Matthew Komen of the U.S. Attorney's Office was challenged by Nagin's supporters as he told reporters of the prosecution's disappointment at the length of the sentence.
What Ray Nagin did was sell his office over and over and over again. The damage that C. Ray Nagin inflicted upon this community, to include you, ma'am, to include you, is incalculable. Is incalculable. We as a community need not and should not accept such public corruption.
The president of the Vatican Bank is to step down in the middle of a major restructuring aimed at stamping out corruption. From FSN's bureau in Rome, Elena Cassas reports.
German financier Ernst von Freyden was appointed to run the Vatican Bank by Pope Benedict 2 days before his own resignation. Now he too is on the way out. He's overseen a cleaning up of the bank, officially known as the Institute of Religious Works, that has closed over 3,000 suspicious accounts. Two of his predecessors are under investigation for money laundering, forcing the bank to clean up its reputation. Every account it holds is being vetted for possible shady dealings. The Vatican says reform will continue under the new top man, French businessman Jean-Baptiste François. Elena Cassas, Rome.
Rome, the latest global location with a full-time feature story news bureau. It's our 18th worldwide. And that is the latest feature story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. German officials have searched the property of a government worker in relation to allegations of spying on behalf of the United States Secret Services. This is the second suspected case of espionage involving the US in Germany in as many weeks, and heaps more strain on an already tested relationship between Washington and Berlin. Leaked NSA documents had earlier revealed allegations that the US was monitoring the calls of German citizens, including the country's leader, Angela Merkel. For more, I spoke to FSN's Berlin correspondent, Ira Spitzer.
Yes, this morning we heard the news that German authorities had searched the home and office of a man in Berlin. And this man is a suspected spy for the U.S. However, no arrests were made, so we don't really have any concrete information yet. But from what we know, this man is an employee of the German Defense Ministry. Some of the German media, in particular, Die Welt, a Berlin newspaper with good sources in the German government, is reporting that this man is a Bundeswehr soldier who was spying for the Americans. So as you can imagine, Germany did not react well. We've had some spying scandals, just another one in the last week. And of course, last summer, we had the Edward Snowden revelations that the NSA was conducting surveillance on German citizens, including tapping Angela Merkel's cell phone.
So, Ira, take us back to last week. Explain what happened there and how that incident, along with the situation we're reading about today, are cutting away at what's already a very frayed relationship between supposed allies, Berlin and Washington.
Yes, last week, a 31-year-old man was arrested and apparently admitted to selling state secrets to an American contact for a period of at least 2 years. This man was an employee of the BND, that's Germany's Foreign Intelligence Agency. As far as his motivation, we don't necessarily know that much yet, but it does appear to be financial. He sold these documents for about 25,000 euros over this period of 2 years. So as far as the relationship between Washington and Berlin, it has been, you could say, strained, at least in terms of national security and espionage types of issues since the NSA revelations from last summer. Now, this week has obviously put a ton more pressure on it. We're getting a lot of calls in the media and from German politicians to reevaluate the relationship with the United States, at least in terms of how much trust the Germans do place in America as a partner who is not going to spy on them, basically. So it is putting some pressure on that relationship.
And Ira, not to take anything away from the importance of this story, but it might have been competing for space for headlines following those remarkable events in Brazil yesterday. You're in the German capital. What was the reaction to that semifinal result?
Yes, well, in contrast to the anger over the spying scandals, we saw some extreme happiness here both last night and continuing into today, although a lot of people did come in late to work today, I'm sure, and that's because Germany defeated Brazil by a shocking score of 7-1 in that World Cup semifinal last night. Now, some Germans may have expected a win with some of Brazil's top players out for the game, but a 7-1 victory, a historic victory in terms of just the goal differential, was shocking. Gives the Germans a ton of momentum going into the World Cup final this Sunday. So Germany is extremely excited about their football team.
Ira Spitzer in Berlin. This is FSN Reports. Twin sisters who are believed to have fled the UK to Syria pose a threat to themselves and potentially their community. That's according to British anti-terrorism officers. The 16-year-olds reportedly left home a few weeks ago, flying to Turkey before crossing the border into Syria. One theory being looked at is the possibility the girls were travelling to meet their brothers, who are thought to have joined the Islamist extremist group ISIS. Some 500 UK Muslims are thought to have joined the Syria conflict. Dr. Erin Marie Saltman is co-author of Jihad Trending, a comprehensive guide to online extremism that's been published by the anti-extremist think tank, the Quillian Foundation. She spoke to Nick Ferrari of Britain's LBC Radio.
What should be understood first and foremost is that their first point of contact with sympathies towards Syrian ISIS individuals would not have been on the computer. So it's very relevant that they already had a family member radicalized. If they were in contact with like-minded sympathizers, then you already have a network to work off of. Mm. And once you cultivate an interest, then you go online, and once you are online, you create your own vacuum of information where you are only going to hear one side of the story.
Okay.
So the online facilitates this radicalization, but it's not necessarily the first spark.
How carefully monitored are the online activities, or is it so broad, so massive, it's just impossible to track?
Well, it is so massive, and what you find is even if you start shutting down radical Twitter accounts or Facebook accounts or websites, the internet is such that it can just reappear almost immediately. So although the CTIRU unit in Britain is taking down extremist terrorist-related sites, there's nothing to predict whether or not that can come back the next day. And we do see Twitter accounts that just reappear under a slightly different name. What we need is actually a larger and broader network of people providing counter-narratives, providing why going to Syria and fighting is not the right answer and why ISIS and other groups are not actually beneficial groups.
Explain the attraction, the allure of jihad.
The allure is a little bit multifaceted. You do have propaganda coming out that this current situation is like a five-star jihad. So you have people on the ground tweeting images about how this is an amazing experience. So there's a thrill of it. Then there's also sympathizers who have been propagandized to believe that the current fight is for Muslims as a whole, that this is for your brothers and sisters that are being attacked by an authoritarian government. The problem is also that Western governments aren't actually countering that perspective, because we're not saying that the Syrian governments are the good guys. In fact, we are admitting that we don't believe that Syria and Iraq are 100% good government. So if we're not countering, we're not saying why, then would you not support ISIS? There aren't actually many other opposition groups that young people are looking at to see, well, how do I make a difference if I wanted to make a difference in that region?
It's a counter-narrative we're lacking then, effectively, Doctor.
We are. And what you see is that in other fights against racism, homophobia, sexism, there is a much stronger online community that attack and counter perversions and manipulations of narratives. So if you get someone online spouting out racism, you will have a community that attacks that. You will have online groups that get rid of myths and work together. You don't currently see that with the majority of the Muslim community, who are a silent majority. And that means the narrative is being hijacked by a very potent and small minority.
Dr. Erin Marie Saltman. Now, the figure appointed to handle the inquiry into child sex abuse allegations surrounding British MPs and public figures has had her suitability pulled into question. It's been revealed that retired Judge Elizabeth Butler Sloss's late brother was Attorney General in the 1980s, the decade when a paedophile ring within the British establishment is alleged to have operated. Two major inquiries into the claims are being set up. Speaking to Britain's LBC Radio, Shadow Attorney General Emily Thornberry was asked if the public were supposed to simply accept that key files detailing these abuse allegations may have been destroyed.
I think you should also bear in mind that Mr. Dickens also gave another copy of the file to the Director of Public Prosecutions. So there's two files, and that second file also went missing. So it's not just that there was one file that somehow or other got destroyed, and there was some sort of... It happened twice, and that's what makes you wonder what on earth was going on. Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely, and what about the public also seeing what we mean?
Exactly, exactly. I mean, I asked the Solicitor General yesterday about this, about, you know, what was the procedure, what has happened to all the documents, could he explain whether there was a breach of that procedure, or, you know, could they explain the absence of the files, what steps the CPS have taken to try and recover the documents. He wasn't able to answer me, and he says that he's going to write to me. I have to say, I was very disappointed by the lack of response that I got from the Solicitor General yesterday. But it just continues to raise questions. I think the public have a right to know. And I think that also we have to make sure that the inquiry that now happens really gets to the bottom of what has happened to these documents, what happened to those allegations, is there any truth in those allegations? And we need to be able to have confidence in a proper review into what was happening. Also, I think it's very important that we learn lessons from it, and we make sure that there are a whole series of reviews going on everywhere. I think it's very important to draw together the lessons that are learnt on that, so that we can make sure that these sorts of things do not happen in future.
As you say, we've got the two now main inquiries on the go as a result. Arguably, though, going back to our top line this morning, arguably one is being led by a firm member of this country's establishment. Do you think that's the way to go? That's the right person?
I think that people very often ask for an independent inquiry led by a High Court judge. I mean, they say a judge-led inquiry, and that is a sort of gold-plated standard, you know? And I think that personally, I think that the person that they've chosen is a woman of great standing, actually, with a great deal of experience, who's been involved in the family courts, and I think that it is an appropriate choice. I think you need to have somebody of standing and who is respected. That's my own personal view. I think the other thing which has come out today is that I think Mr. Wanless, who's in charge of the NSPCC, who's also involved in this inquiry, has called for it to be a criminal offence not to pass on allegations of abuse. I don't know if you've picked up on that on LBC. But I think that's an important aspect of the evidence. There's been a big campaign saying that if you know of allegations of child abuse, if you don't pass on those allegations, you should be prosecuted. Now, I think that there's something in this. I think that, speaking entirely personally, that I don't think that it is sufficient to pass on suspicions, because I would be worried about what that meant. But I think that if you're in a position of being, if a child has been handed over to your care and you're entrusted with that child, and you know that there has been an offence against that child, either because you've seen it or because the child has told you, then I think that you should be prosecuted if you don't pass on those allegations.
And I think that will find a lot of support. Emily Thornberry, we have to leave it there. Really appreciate your time this morning.
Shadow Attorney General Emily Thornberry. This is FSN Reports. It was a World Cup semi-final that would see records tumble and Brazilian hearts break as the host country were bounced from the competition in a dramatic 7-1 drubbing at the hands of the Germans.
I'm almost speechless, you know, I've never seen Germany ruling a game like that.
One down, two down, they were like, okay, Brazil's going to come back, Brazil's going to come back. Then every time Germany touches, they score, couldn't believe it.
I don't know, there isn't words to explain a match like that.
President Dilma Rousseff took to Twitter following the match to will the population to dust themselves down and move forward. World Cup correspondent Lawrence Morrow was there to see firsthand the reaction in Brazil to last night's humiliating defeat.
There was pockets of sporadic violence, I think is the best way to describe it. We understand that there were outbreaks of fighting in Belo Horizonte after the game. There were certain German fans who asked to remain within the stadium until the crowd had dissipated, sort of pockets of fighting breaking out in the stadium amongst Brazil fans themselves. I was on the Copacabana last night in the fan fest. I have to say that personally I didn't really see anything. There was few skirmishes outside of the fan fest, but I did speak to fans later as they sort of got back onto the metro system. And they had complained about being sort of targeted. There were thieves trying to rob people on the beach and sort of using it almost as an excuse to start fighting with the police. And they talked about quite a scary sort of incident there, but the good thing, I think the thing that sort of stopped all of that sort of violence or that outpouring of anger was the monsoon that hit the the Copacabana just as the full-time whistle went and pretty much sent everybody sort of scampering for safety indoors.
Now, of course, soaked. Well, now, of course, on the pitch, an absolute shocker. Is it Brazil's biggest World Cup upset in 94 years? Is that right?
The match was an absolute incredible game, wasn't it? 5-0 down in 29 minutes and is the biggest defeat for Brazil since 1920. Not just the defeat, just humiliation. It was almost as if once Germany had scored their second goal, the Brazil just froze. They sort of realized the enormity of this defeat that was staring them in the face. And then they were 5-0 down a few minutes later. Germany were absolutely superb from start to finish. Far too good for Brazil, who will come out of this with no credit at all.
And what happens next?
Well, Phil Scolari, the former Chelsea manager, has come out and he's begged for forgiveness for his players. David Luiz has spoken and said how sorry he is for Brazil's humiliation. Julio Cesar, the QPR goalkeeper, said something similar here in Brazil. There's going to be much gnashing of teeth and wailing, I think, is the long and short of it. But, you know, if you remember back to 1950, the defeat to Uruguay, Brazilians still talk about that. That's still a huge issue for them, losing to Uruguay in the Maracanã in the World Cup final. They haven't forgotten that all this time on. This is going to be a huge scar on Brazil's footballing history.
World Cup correspondent Lawrence Mora talking to LBC Radio's Jim Diamond. And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, as various states emulate Colorado's lead and consider permitting the sale of recreational marijuana, in Britain last week, the government banned the sale or consumption of a relatively mild stimulant by the name of cut. Cut, spelt K-H-A-T, is a leaf that is native to the Horn of Africa and is extremely popular in countries including Somalia, Yemen and Ethiopia. And among diaspora communities in the USA and Britain, it's popular too, despite the fact that the World Health Organization has classified it as a drug that can produce mild to moderate psychological dependence. Cut has been prescribed in the United States since 1993, and Britain's Home Secretary Theresa May says it must now be prohibited in the UK because there's a risk that Britain will turn into a distribution point for the drug if it remains legal. Alex Miller is the UK editor-in-chief of Vice, and he's written extensively about Cut. He told Clive Bull of Britain's LBC Radio that he thinks the ban is a mistake.
Basically, cat is a kind of mild stimulant that grows in trees, mostly in kind of West Africa. And basically, you pick off the stems, you chew them, and supposedly it gives you a kind of a mild buzz, a kind of a very kind of small euphoric high. But actually, I mean, the feeling itself is not very intense. There's even a quote from Charles Dickens where he talks about the Europeans who are used to more kind of potent stimulants wouldn't even register its feelings.
So this has been around for hundreds or even more years than that?
Well, it's certainly been chewed for hundreds of years and is especially kind of popular with Somali people and West Africans. And it's mostly chewed in places called mafrishas, which are cafes where generally men kind of gather to, you know, watch football on telly, smoke cigarettes, chew cat, and, you know, talk about the day.
And have you tried it yourself?
I have. I spent a few weeks in Kenya making a film about this drug with the ban coming up. And, yeah, I chewed quite a lot of it.
And what effect did it have, did you feel?
The effect of a mild coffee. I mean, the thing is, it does kind of give you a slight energetic buzz, but you remember when you first ever tried coffee when you were a kid and it actually made you feel a little bit jittery and a little bit nervous, but then as time went on, that kind of disappeared? Well, it's much like when you first drink coffee.
Presumably, from what you're saying then, you are unimpressed with the idea of this being made illegal today.
It's very unfair on a kind of group of British citizens for whom this is an important part of their culture. I mean, this is something that many kind of Somalis or Kenyans living in Britain will have been doing their whole lives. This will be their method of relaxing. I mean, the mafrish really just is their version of a pub. And I think it's kind of harsh that it's been taken away from them. Certainly from a kind of chemical perspective, I can't see any argument as to why it should be banned. I mean, it's not a drug which you can overdose on. I mean, I know some protesters have said that there are kind of 15 deaths linked with it, but actually if you analyze those deaths, you know, one of them is by a heroin overdose. These are 15 people who've had the drug in their system when they've happened to die. I mean, the link is very tenuous in the extreme. And so, yeah, I'm very unimpressed.
So why is Theresa May choosing to do this then, do you think?
Well, I think there's a few possible reasons. I think that a likely reason is pressure from the United States. It's been illegal there for 20 years, although it is still successfully and rather easily smuggled into that country. But I think they're kicking people into line. One of the things that she said is that because it's illegal there and because it's been illegalized across many countries in Europe, she's worried that England will become a hub for trafficking. But if you ask me, that there's a certain irony in trying to stop crime by illegalizing something. I think that actually quite a lot of the users, importers, the people who run the mafreshes will be forced into crime due to this legislation.
And what do you think will happen? Will it just be driven underground and people will still chew it, still use it?
Look at the number of people who smoke weed or do coke or whatever. It's not like making a drug illegal has ever actually successfully worked. The war against drugs isn't littered with successes. I mean, when I was in Kenya, I met some people who showed me how they smuggled it into the States. I mean, and it was not a sophisticated process. They bundled it up with some yellow pages, put it in a box, wrote an address on it, and sent it off. And I imagine it will still find ways of coming through. I mean, the real shame is for those few people who were importing it in bulk, who will have that livelihood taken from them.
And presumably, yeah, there are people in this country as well whose business it was to deal in it perfectly legally. They're going to have to find something else to do.
Which, you know, as you know, right now isn't the easiest thing to do in London. And I think for a community as marginalised as the Somalian one in London, it's a real blow. I mean, it's quite a fantastic process, the international cat trade, because by the nature of the drug, it has to be picked 48 hours before it's consumed. Otherwise, it kind of loses all its power. So you start off in the middle of nowhere in Kenya, where people pick it from the trees at dawn. It's bundled up incredibly quickly, thrown on the back of trucks which speed all the way to Nairobi. It's repackaged. They're sped to the airport. It's flown to Heathrow. It's dragged off the planes. It's thrown into a depot. And then people in cars from all around the country come, turn up, pick up their orders, drive off to the local mafreshes, drop them off where the users are waiting. It's really quite impressive, and that, of course, now has to stop.
That's Alex Miller, the editor-in-chief of the British edition of Vice. You can find his writing and videos on Cut and a host of other issues at vice.com. He was talking there to Clive Bull of Britain's LBC Radio. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Thursday, as Brazil crash out of the World Cup, we find out how the tournament with the $11 billion price tag could influence the country's political future. That's Thursday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Simon Marks with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.